Welcome back to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. I'm Jeff Cook. I just want to start here and read an excerpt from a paper written by this week's guest. You ready? Okay, here we go. In this paper, we explore the properties of gravitational lensing by black holes in the Randall-Sundrum 2 brain world. We use numerical techniques to calculate lensing observables using the tidal Reisner-Nordström TRN and Garga Tanaka metrics to examine supermassive black holes and primordial black holes. We introduce a new way to parameterize tidal charge in the TRN metric, which results in a large increase in image magnifications for brain world primordial black holes compared to their four-dimensional analogs. Okay, still with me? Doesn't sound much like automotive or transportation, does it? This paper is from the journal Physical Review D. It appeared in 2010. It was written by Amitai Bin Nunn. Amitai is a PhD physicist, you probably gathered, who for a while did work on black holes as a window to extra dimensions. Today, he is vice president of autonomous vehicles and mobility innovation at an organization called Securing America's Future Energy, or SAFE, based in Washington, D.C. SAFE aims to accelerate the deployment of vehicle automation and maximize the energy security and social benefits of the technology. Amitai worked in strategy at KPMG, was an associate at Harvard's Kennedy School, and worked for U.S. Senator Chris Coons, who represents Delaware, was a AAAS fellow at the Department of Energy. Impressive stuff. Two last things, then I'll get to the interview, which is done by Ed again. I think Ed is just killing it as a podcast host, by the way. Number one, Amitai is actually the second PhD physicist we've had on the show, and we're not even to episode 20 yet. If you missed it, you can go back and listen to the episode with Daniel Clark, who does sensor fusion work for us in Germany. Daniel explained to me how interpreting sensor data from distant stars and so on isn't all that different from dealing with data from sensors on vehicles. Pretty cool. Number two, if you want to hear more from Amitai's organization, the guys over at Autonicast were at an innovation summit sponsored by SAFE last fall in Miami. They wound up doing an episode featuring SAFE founder and CEO Robbie Diamond. Amitai makes a cameo appearance in the episode as well. Check it out. It's episode 114. Those guys are great interviewers. I'm a major Autonicast fan, and the show is certainly a must-listen for anyone in this space. Anyway, that's all from me. Now here's Ed and Amitai.
All of a sudden, cars can look different. They don't need to be sized for the biggest use case. So I think when you combine automation and not needing a driver with the ability to summon a vehicle on demand, there's almost no limit to where our imaginations could take us for what vehicles might look like.
Welcome back to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. As you've probably come to discover if you've listened to our past episodes, our work as it relates to the auto industry is pretty global. I'm Ed Bernardin, the VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives here at Siemens, and in this week's episode, I interviewed Amitai Bin Nunn, the Vice President of Autonomous Vehicles at Securing America's Future Energy, or SAFE. I asked Amitai about his background and what led him to SAFE.
Sure, no, thank you, Ed. And it's been a really interesting ride. You know, when I started my career, self-driving cars weren't really a twinkle in that many people's eyes. So kind of everyone who's in this space has come to it from something else. And for me, it was always a deep interest in technology and its role on society and how we organize our rules from a government perspective, from a private sector perspective, to use technology to better people's lives. So I started as a theoretical physicist. I studied black holes in graduate school. And as graduate school was coming to a close, I didn't know what I was going to do next, but I knew I was very interested in policy and politics and figuring out how we guide the use of science and technology to make people's lives better. So I got a fellowship and spent a couple of years first at the Department of Energy and then on Capitol Hill, where I looked at different aspects of science and technology, what the rules and regulations and laws that govern them are, and how we should change them to help maximize the impact of technology on society. During that time, I got really interested in self-driving cars and general innovation in transportation. So I spent a couple years as a consultant at KPMG Strategy, where I worked with their automotive sector and helped companies in the space manage the transitions that we're really seeing really take off right now, an increase in speed. And then for the last 3 years, I've been at SAFE, where it's our job to help governments regulate self-driving cars in a way that promotes innovation and allows the full potential of the technology to get there. And a big part of that story is also articulating why society should care and should want self-driving cars, whether it's from an economic growth perspective, from a safety perspective, or from an accessibility perspective.
As a physicist, Amitai studied black holes, so I had to ask him if he felt that that study prepared him for the mystery world of government rules and regulation, and if there were any parallels between the two. I was curious to know what his thoughts were on the innovative aspects of the autonomous vehicle industry and how those mystery rules and regulation can potentially hinder the growth of autonomous vehicles.
Nothing can prepare you for what you experience in Washington. But seriously though, there actually is a lot of parallel. As a physicist, you're always looking at a complicated system and you're trying to cut through all the complexity and try to understand what are the key drivers of this system? What are the most important variables that we have to impact and how can we make change happen? And I think regulating, legislating, and thinking about the role of technology in society is very much the same way. There's a lot of noise and a lot of hype. And you have to say, well, what are the governing changes? What do I have to do in order to make sure this technology has an impact? What should I be laser-like focused on in order to make sure that the technology is successful? And because otherwise, you could end up running around and chasing whatever the latest trend is. But if you have a deep understanding of the broader system, it also helps you understand what the key drivers of change are and it lets you act on that.
So knowing where the key drivers are headed gives you a great feel for what the benefits are going to be. And regulation is important to keep us safe. And at the same time, regulation can also stifle innovation. And it seems like there's a key balance between these two things. And it seems also that that's what SAFE focuses on.
Ed, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Innovation is incredibly important to us as a society. It's where economic growth comes from. It's what makes our standard of life better over time. And that's why so many countries talk so much about innovation and dedicate so many resources to make sure innovation happens there. Because if you make sure innovation happens in your borders, it's your citizens who benefit. That said, anytime there's anything new, there's always risks involved. And regulation is about how you manage those risks and ensure that they don't get in the way of the benefits that innovation offers. Innovation by itself isn't useful unless it solves a problem or it makes life better for people. So I think we see it as our mission. We absolutely think there has to be regulations around self-driving cars. If it's done right, it doesn't only prevent people from putting things which aren't ready to be on the roads, but it also gives a signal to the public that the technology is safe. It gives a signal to the companies who are developing the technology when their tech is ready for deployment and ready for prime time. So regulation has a big role in both not only allowing innovation, but also, if done right, encouraging it as well.
On a serious note, it can't be easy regulating that space, especially when an issue arises. Amitai is a scientist, and he possesses a level of expertise that provides him with a deeper level of understanding. However, let's step into the shoes of our policymakers. How do they reconcile public outcry when incidents such as the accident with Uber early this year occurs? In addition to the public, layer in the input from those in the tech space, engineers, CEO, experts that are all informing them that these vehicles are safe. I asked Amitai what his thoughts were on how to properly balance the input from these two different audiences to find the right regulation. A regulation that both provides structure and preserves the competitive nature of the space.
A huge part of getting this balance right, about ensuring public safety while also encouraging innovation, is getting the process right. We don't want governments to be heavy-handed and to say, well, what sort of systems get to go on the road? Well, you have to have a LiDAR, or you have to use a deep learning algorithm. Now, those would be over-interventions and over-regulation. Right now, there is generally a permissive framework around autonomous vehicles because very few governments have passed laws restricting their use. So right now, we don't really have the tools to take a deep look at a system and say, this is safe or this is not safe. That's something that develops with time. And generally, if you look at the history of the regulation of either the airline industry or the regulation of the automotive industry, usually the technology has to be in use for a really long amount, a really fair amount of time before the language and the standardization of approaches in industry emerges, which allows for effective regulation. So I think right now, governments are involved at different levels, but right now the best approach is observe closely, put in place relatively light guardrails to ensure that well-meaning actors are the ones who are able to deploy their technologies on the road, but you're observing carefully to make sure that this progresses in a safe way and you're learning more about the technology in order so that you can put in a more effective guidelines over time. It's a long process, and certainly it's going to be informed by experts in both inside and outside government because it's a very broad and very big question. But I think the key operative word is patience and process and taking the time to get it right rather than rushing to try to pass judgment on a technology or a specific manufacturer.
And it seems like there's also going to have to be cooperation, right? A dialogue that's ongoing between the vehicle manufacturers, the customers of these vehicles, and the government, right?
I think that's true on so many fronts. First of all, one of the most exciting things about autonomous vehicles is that they don't have to ever make the same mistake twice. All of us who drive learn to drive at one point. And everyone who drives now was once a new driver and made certain mistakes that novice drivers make. And the reason why the crash risk is highest for 18 to 24-year-olds. The good news about autonomous vehicles is right now they may be novice drivers and they're learning and getting up to speed. But the more they learn, the quicker, the more they advance, and they don't forget. And so the more we can get industry to work together to help train and autonomous vehicles, the quicker it'll learn and the quicker this pathway to safety happens.
Well, that's an interesting thing too, is like you're saying, if you take an individual manufacturer, right, as their vehicle one learns something, they can teach it to vehicle 2 through 1,000. But now you have multiple manufacturers, right, each with thousands of vehicles. It would be great if all of them could learn from all of their vehicles. And of course, companies are going to say, well, all the knowledge I've gained, you know, that's that we worked hard for that. And they may not want to share. Isn't that a role that government can play to, I don't know if forcing is the right word, but somehow trying to take advantage of this learning that's going on so it can be shared by everyone? How does government make that happen? Or can they even help with that, do you think?
You're absolutely right in that. I don't expect, you know, the biggest companies in the space, Waymo and Cruise, to open up the doors of their servers and to share all the training data with every actor in the space. I think, you know, that's not the way our society works. It's not the way capitalism works. But there is actually a fair amount of cooperation that happens. Like, most self-driving cars are built with open source tools that were built by technology companies and then released. Most companies in the space participate on standards bodies in which they're slowly but surely building an approach to try to standardize the architecture systems or how you might benchmark how safe they are. So, and this being Silicon Valley, or a lot of the industry being in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of movement between companies and by, you know, engineers, and there's a lot of knowledge that gets shared that way. So I think a lot of it happens organically. I think the way government has a role in this is when the Department of Transportation signals that they would like to create a standard around self-driving cars, that triggers a process in which, you know, they might reach out to standards bodies like the Society of Automotive Engineers. They might ask the body to help them create the standards around self-driving cars. And once that ship is moving, everyone in the industry would like to participate in it or needs to participate in it, because you want your vision of self-driving cars to be reflected in that eventual standard. So the government can do a lot to accelerate this cooperation by giving more clarity about its timeline for when it wants to regulate, how it wants to regulate, and also by engaging in joint products or collaborative research.
Magic wand in hand, Amitai is able to gather the key people in government in a room with the top mobility service providers, autonomous car companies, technical leads, and CEOs. What are the top issues that he would have them address? What does he feel is truly needed for us to see real progress in this space?
In my mind, the most important issue for this industry to coalesce around is a common language for safety. Now, I don't mean a common technical approach where they all try to take the same approach towards building a self-driving car. I'm not suggesting that they have a commitment to using the same tools or having the same processes. I think those will come in time. But I think there's a real need for having a common language with how you talk about safety and how safe you want your vehicles to be before they deploy. I think that's really important for a couple of reasons. One is self-driving cars are incredibly scrutinized, which means the second they're put on the road, and they're already on the road, people are looking to see, and every time there's an accident that involves these vehicles, it makes headlines. And that means that even though there are 100 fatal car accidents in the U.S. a day, even more minor accidents involving self-driving cars get a lot more attention. So in that environment, how do you, as a corporate board, decide that I'm ready to take the risk of putting my vehicles on the road? It turns out that's a really hard decision, because your vehicles might be safe, or, you know, safer than a human driver, but they're never going to be perfect. So at what point do you pull the trigger and do you say, I'm ready to make a launch? So I think that process is, it's not just a technological process, but it's not just a technological question, it's a sociological question. And I think the more that we have a common language and a common agreement amongst industry about what that trigger point is, I think that's going to benefit public perception, and that's going to benefit the companies that are in a difficult but envious position of having to make that decision.
Amitai raises a great point. What defines safe? Of course, service providers are going to launch with communication about how safe their product is. But having a common industry-wide language around safety would establish a clear understanding of what's to be expected with each launch. I asked Amitai for his definition of a safe autonomous car.
The question you're raising is something that the industry is really grappling with, because as you said, we already have 50 years worth of rules on the books about how you determine whether a car is safe, and it has to do with how it performs on crash tests, how the brakes perform, how tense are the seatbelts. And you could do all those things and it wouldn't tell you anything about how safe your self-driving car is, because that all has to do with how well the software performs when it's put on the road. Generally, I think we have to make this, the way that you're going to go about and technically verify that self-driving cars are safe might be complicated technically. It might have to involve using simulators or lists of driving scenarios that you have to master and that are being compiled by some organizations working in the space right now. But I think when we ultimately face the public, I think companies should be able to represent to the public that they're serving that self-driving cars are as safe as a human driver. And that communicates, I mean, they should be, and they should be safer than that, and they should continue to get safer. But I think to ethically say that this is something that we're serving the public by putting on the road, if it's safer than the driver that it's replacing, I think you can make a pretty strong case that you're positively impacting society by replacing human drivers with software-driven cars that are better, that make better decisions, that get into crashes less often, and make less risky decisions. Now, the million-dollar question, or maybe even multi-billion-dollar question, is how do you know that? Now, that's something that we don't have a full answer yet, too. But I think we know the question. We know the question, and it's, when are you safer than a human driver? We may not know. We're still working on, well, what are the technical tools and methods we need to say that we're at that point?
You know, it's interesting, right, that there's a standard for how safe a human driver has to be. You take your driver's test or whatever, or you know, the number of accidents you might have and the rates on your insurance or whatever it might be. But doesn't it seem that we're going to expect more from autonomous cars? They have to be better than human drivers. It doesn't seem to be going in that direction.
Absolutely. So I think a driving test or some insurance type measurement where you observe the car and you try to assess how risky a self-driving car is, that might be part of the solution for figuring out whether they're safe. Now, certainly there are a lot of processes that companies use internally, like compliance with software architecture standards or extensive test track testing or simulation, that help answer the question, that tries to both build a car to be safe and also to verify that it performs safely in a broad range of scenarios before deployment. Now, what's the end goal of this? We're currently in a world where 100 people a day die on public roads from car crashes. Self-driving cars have the potential to do much, much better than that. And I think the ultimate goal has to be zero. But that said, if we can't be focused, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, so to speak. If we say that a self-driving car can't be deployed until it's perfect, till we can assure 100% that I'll never get into a car accident, we'll never get them on the road, and we'll never get even the significant improvements on safety that I can offer in the interim while we're still working on that ultimate goal.
In addition to the potential safety improvements Amitai describes, autonomous cars also come with a number of additional benefits, such as reducing the cost of transportation or providing convenience and making transportation accessible to a larger audience. With so many benefits, it seems unfair to apply such staunch requirements for these cars to be 100% accident-free and to even exceed human driving abilities. I worry we may be cheating ourselves as a result of this.
I think you're capturing the value proposition of self-driving cars, and that it goes beyond safety. Listen, I think safety is critical, is what we call a critical path for self-driving cars. If they're not going to be safer than a human driver, they're not going to make it on our roads. That's got to happen. But once we get to that, there's a whole host of benefits that come with self-driving and that have the opportunity to really address and improve a broad range of societal issues in a significant way. So we did a study about 2 years ago, the impact of autonomous vehicles on people with disabilities. And we found that there's about 4 million people who almost never leave their home because they're not able to use transportation. And there's about 8 million people of working age with disabilities who are unemployed or underemployed and wouldn't be if their workforce participation rate was at the same rate as the rest of the population. So self-driving cars don't solve everyone's issue. There's a whole bunch of issues around wheelchair assets, but there's a lot of people who, as soon as you put self-driving cars on the road, and they can suddenly get to where they want to go because they have access to transportation. We hear a lot from the blind community how they think the access to cheap on-demand transportation is going to be a game changer for their ability to integrate in society and to have better socioeconomic and health outcome for its members. And there's also, that doesn't mean there's not a lot of work to do around reaching the entire disability population, but I think self-driving cars are a great tool to bring access to a broad range of the population that doesn't have it today, whether it's because of a disability, it's because they're growing older and don't feel confident in their ability to drive, or because they are economically disadvantaged and can't afford to have a car and don't live in an area that's well served by public transportation. So these are all pretty significant opportunities that self-driving cars can help us achieve.
We're actually at a great turning point, right, for the disabled, let's just say, where you have an opportunity to redesign vehicles, not just from an autonomy standpoint, but the entire vehicle itself, right? The driver disappears, and now suddenly there's more room in the vehicle or whatever it might be. But there's also, you could think of a downside here, which is if you have a conductor in a train or a bus driver, then they're there to help that disabled person get on or off the train, right? Or on or off the bus. Now, if it becomes autonomous, now the bus itself has to provide that help. And I know there's, in a conventional vehicle, there might be ramps or lifts or something like that, let's just say, to help someone get in and out that's not able to do it on their own. But in Europe, for instance, the bus is lower down and they're almost at curb height. That seems to me could be a great area where government could help, right? And say, hey, if we're going to start redesigning vehicles, it's not just about AI algorithms and this and that, but why not take an opportunity now and just relook at all the kinds of vehicles that are out there? Because it's no longer about just making somebody happy about a car so they buy it. It's really about creating transportation that in combination, right, serves the needs of a lot of people. And who knows what those vehicles might look like? What are your thoughts on how government can help us think in that way, think in a new way about what transportation really is?
And so before we get into government role, I think let's talk about the status quo a little bit. So right now, one of the best ways for people who with disabilities to get around, if they can't use a car or if they can't easily use public transportation, is through paratransit services that cities are providing as a supplement to their public transportation offering. So those are really expensive for cities to offer. Cost ranges from city to city, but it could be as much as $70 or $80 a ride. And the service level from what we hear from users could be a lot better. Now, you have to schedule a day or more in advance. Your pickup time is not very specific, and the reliability is not very high. Now, this is a very valuable service. But the thinking is, if we have self-driving cars, that gives us a tool where we can make the vehicle itself and the driver cheaper, that $70 a ride can go pretty far in terms of either purchasing the features that will make the vehicle more accessible or having onboard help to be able to interact with clients who may need additional attention to be able to get and be on board. So I think it's not that self-driving cars as a technology is the be-all and end-all solution, but it fits into a broader system and gives you a broader set of capabilities to play with and also helps that some of that cost that now goes into the vehicle and the driver go into other innovations, which may let you be able to provide a better service at a lower price for cities. Again, better service for the population you're serving.
I suppose the bus driver, right, could, in an autonomous bus, doesn't have to drive, and they could dedicate 100% of their time to helping people that are in the bus or someone getting on or off the bus. And if the cost of transportation is much lower for whatever reason, you probably get that service for more affordably than you can get it now.
Absolutely. And I think that's why we have to focus. Self-driving technology is a tool. It's a transportation tool. And we have to think about, well, how's this going to fit into the broader system? And what are the first order and second order impacts going to be? And does this tool give us more ability to deliver accessible rides for the same budget that we do now? And I think the answer to that is yes. So the technology itself doesn't necessarily provide all the capability you need, but actually might make it easier and cheaper and more effective to deliver the capability you want.
Now, With so many great benefits afoot, it raised that same question of what is the government's role in this space?
The other week, I was out in California where the California Public Utilities Commission is holding hearings or rulemakings on this very question about what the accessibility requirements should be for a self-driving car service. And they're examining these questions. Should we require that all the vehicles to be wheelchair accessible? Should we require someone to be shown to be on the road, a caretaker to be in the vehicle at all times? You know, I think that's a process that's going to play out. I think they're going to have to figure out what the balance is between letting companies put a service out on the road on their term versus ensuring that it helps improve the accessibility of the public that the regulators have a mandate to serve. So I think we're going to see that, and we're going to be watching that because really the first proceedings of this kind in the country where we're looking at the accessibility of self-driving cars. One other point is you'd mentioned the ability to change around the vehicle. And we're already seeing some pretty interesting approaches to that. So there's a couple of companies that are working on self-driving mini shuttles. So they basically look like kind of tram cars, but they're smaller and they're on wheels and they go autonomously. So, and they have a lot of potential because they have a lot of room inside to be accessible. And some of them are even fitted with wheelchair ramps. So we think that sort of model has a lot of potential to improve accessibility. And where I'm talking about shuttles like Ali, the Navia, the Easy Mile, Easy 10, these are all built with accessibility in mind. Now, because these vehicles to have a room go autonomously already and don't have a driver inside, they want to maximize the room inside, there's no brake pedals or steering wheel inside the vehicle. And so technically, it does not comply with current regulations. And there's been some issues with getting these on the road.
From the perspective of design, these autonomous vehicles will eventually call for their own unique design. That is, designing these vehicles from a blank slate as opposed to trying to modify current vehicle designs. I asked Amitai if regulation could have a hand in nudging manufacturers into an innovative space sooner and ensuring that they're considering the needs of disabled populations in their designs.
So we have no idea about where the design of the vehicle could go. And that's one of the most exciting things about being in the space and sitting here at the end of the 2018 as it's about to turn into 2019. Because I look at pictures from 120 years ago from the dawn of the automobile, and the first cars look like horse carriages without the horse, because that was the most natural place your mind took you if you were building one of these vehicles. You were like, okay, let's take the transportation of today and let's stick the engine on. And then over time, we realized, well, the car is a different mode of transportation that needs a different form factor. And that's a process that took place over decades. So we don't know how, if you really and truly don't need a driver, what does that do to the sort of vehicle you design? At the very least, we can think about, and secondly, what's even more powerful is when you marry this to an on-demand form of transportation. So, you know, I don't need to buy a minivan because I once in a while schlep around three kids because, you know, if I can get the car I need when I need it, all of a sudden cars can look different. They don't need to be sized for the biggest use case. So I think when you combine automation and not needing a driver with the ability to summon a vehicle on demand, there's almost no limit to where our imaginations could take us for what vehicles might look like.
In speaking to design, we also broached the topic of micromobility. These autonomous designs will eventually need to take into account the micromobility traveler who's looking to take a quick trip within a short radius. Amitai shared his insights on this and municipal regulations.
I love that you connected micromobility to the conversation. And I think the way you've connected it is exactly right. The reason why scooters excite people is not because they're little fun vehicles that are fun to use to get around downtown, but it really is like maybe an early manifestation of the idea that your car that you keep in your driveway is not the right vehicle for every trip you might want to take. And the more that we can decouple the vehicle, you know, the vehicle you buy from the one you use on each trip, the more we can get you the right amount of mobility or the right vehicle for the exact trip you want to take. So maybe it is something that looks like a scooter or a scooter-like or small electric pod if you're doing a small short trip. And maybe it is something that looks more like a vehicle if you're taking your stuff all the way up to the mountains so you can go skiing. But a lot has to happen to realize this vision. So I think first is there are some fairly rigid restrictions around what sort of designs you can try in the vehicle space, because we've designed regulations for 50 years around the idea of a driver, and those don't just go away overnight. At some point, we should talk about the legislation in front of Congress that, among other things, would allow more experimentation in that space. But there's also a lot that has to be done on the infrastructure level and on the city management level to create the right space for some of this experimentation. Some of the regulatory innovation has to be on the design side. Some of the regulatory innovation has to be on the usage side. And, you know, as usual, most innovation has to be in the private sector to actually figure out what are the capital deployment models so that we can actually create a sustainable business where people use different vehicles for different trips. Now, Uber and Lyft kind of started that, but really, I think what makes people excited about scooters and e-bikes is that it's really the first time people are thinking about taking trips that are not in either a car or public transportation or walking. And that's really the first time in a really long time that, you know, that new options have emerged. I think part of the reaction we're seeing from some cities, and cities have fallen in a broad range of positions relative to these new options. So we have some cities like Santa Monica, California, which have embraced their role as kind of a central ground zero of scooter and e-bike deployment. And some like New York City, which have categorically prohibited these dockless bikes and scooters, except in some small areas right at the very outskirts of the city. And part of this is a reaction to what the dynamic you've identified, how they experienced the rollout of Uber and Lyft, and the determination to be proactive and to shape the deployment of the tech to benefit their cities. So I think it's certainly an understandable reaction. So what I would like to see happen is to see the micromobility companies and the transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft help better articulate the benefit that these technologies offer to cities. And I think once that's articulated, and I think it's demonstrated to provide a lot of value to many cities, it becomes easier and easier to bring them down the line. And I think in terms of how they should be deployed, I mean, I really think that's going to be a city by city call in terms of how close, how you engage with government. Cities are so different that it's hard to have a one size fits all.
And I think you're right, though. And the scooter example in Cambridge is probably a good one. Although they stepped in and say, hey, we're going to regulate, there was an outcry by the users of those scooters that said, hey, these are great. It really actually helps things in the city, right? I mean, if you can get a smaller footprint per person traveling, it's got to help with congestion and convenience. And in the end, that's what won out. So like you say, getting cities to know how these technologies can benefit them and people to understand that they exist is probably one of the biggest challenges, right? To make everyone aware of the benefits that they can actually get from all this.
I think because scooters especially, I mean, use of scooters in cities is about a year old. The dockless scooters that you pick up using an app. And even in the grand scheme of things, Uber and Lyft aren't that old. So I think it's not fully appreciated what the positives and negatives of their introduction to cities are. I think there's a lot of speculation. And I think in some cities, some of the negative narratives have won out. So as I mentioned, New York City, as an example, has not allowed the deployment of e-scooters, and they've started to increasingly regulate Uber and Lyft. Right now, no new drivers are allowed on the platform, and they've imposed minimum wage requirement, as well as congestion fees that are specific to Uber and Lyft. And my concern is sometimes regulations run ahead of the evidence to support them. Now, certainly there's a lot of Uber and Lyfts in New York City. Certainly there's a lot of congestion in New York City. However, I don't think that correlation necessarily implies a causation. And I think certainly some of the policies that have very specifically targeted Uber and Lyft with fees meant to discourage their use aren't necessarily the best set of policies for the goals of easing transportation through cities. And what I'd like to see emerge is more analysis that gets to that question of, well, if you're, what equity are you trying to improve? If you're trying to improve access, if you're trying to reduce congestion, well, what are the set of policies that you might adopt inclusive of transportation network companies and scooters? Because I see them certainly having a role and a potential and being a potential part of the solution. And my worry is that some of the policies that are emerging so far treat them solely as potential problems rather than a tool to be engaged as a solution to improve transportation and equities in cities.
So right now, you pull out an app, and you order your Lyft or your Uber or whatever it might be, and maybe it's a scooter or a Zipcar. But in the future, especially when government and cities are part of the whole thing, you might also want to have in there a train or a subway, whatever it might be. And suddenly, in order to provide that joint service, you have to take information that, say, Uber owns, right, of where all their customers are moving, and even Lyft, both of them, and share it with the city that knows where their trains are and who might be on those trains or whatever, and put that all into one system so that you can truly, or maybe more efficiently, take advantage of all these different types of transportation, right, from the train to the car down to the little scooter. Do you think that, especially like the big mobility providers now, like Uber and Lyft, are ever going to want to share their data with cities? Do you think that the government maybe has to federate the data or force it to be shared, possibly, in order to make this multi-mode transportation become a reality?
I think this is going to be a topic that's going to keep us busy for a long time. And I know the one that we've discussed before and we love to discuss. There's a really meaty philosophical question here in which, right, there's this exchange of value. The private sector, Uber and Lyft, are providing some services. They're providing some part of the equation. They're providing the rides in cars, you know, pretty soon the rides in on bikes, pretty soon the rides on scooters. They provide some of the delivery services through Uber Eats. And they'd like to complement this, and they see some value by pulling information from the city about where the trains are, how they're performing, and by hitting, you know, the city's data interface, the city's API, to get access to transit data. And so, you know, they'd like to pull the city's data and put it into the Uber universe or the Lyft universe and present a curated product for their consumer and make the consumer's experience more seamless. I think there is an argument that can be made that, like, that they are adding value to the public, and that they're adding value by presenting transit as an option and integrating it into their vision of transportation. But I think what cities also need to get some value out of this, and I think the value that cities need to get out of this, is cities need to ensure certain outcomes. They need to ensure that underserved areas are being served by their transportation system. They need to ensure that they need to be able to plan and see where they need to build more road capacity or how they need to sync their signals or where they need to build new subway lines. And now, in this world, they only have an incomplete part of the picture because they only see the transit part of the equation. They're not seeing everything that's going on in the Uber universe or the Lyft universe. So, I mean, I believe that there is some middle ground where cities get the information they need to reach the ends they need, and Uber and Lyft fulfill their need to offer a product that is compelling to consumers and offer them value. And if we are able to formulate that middle ground, I think everyone wins. I think the challenge is that a lot of the models I've seen so far have been where cities would like extremely detailed information from private sector actors. And I'm certainly sympathetic to the notion that because the city provides access to their roads, that they should have some visibility into what happens on their roads. But I think this is going to work better if cities are very clear about what they're trying to achieve and how information and what specific information from the private sector can support it. And the more narrowly, the more tailored this conversation becomes, I think the easier it becomes to meet everyone's goals. And I think this is just a really important area to push on, a really important way to get to a reality where we can have seamless transportation, you know, across modes and try to achieve, because ultimately that's how you drive down emissions, make travel more efficient, make it more predictable, and make it more accessible. I think that's how we get there.
I mean, that's a great point, right? Is if you go in and you ask for everything, you're not going to get anything at all. But if the transportation provider knows, oh, well, you need this information in order to help schedule a train, and you only need this sliver of it, then maybe that's the way to do it. Because in the long run, I would think that's even going to help the mobility service provider, right? Because if you know you can hop on a Lyft, say, and it takes you to a train, and there's a Lyft at the other end picking you up, I mean, it's a win-win, right?
Absolutely. I think I want to show you, know, there's an example of what's been happening in the autonomous vehicle space. California has asked for a lot of reporting requirements. They say if you operate an autonomous vehicle on the road, they want to know for how many miles were you in an autonomous zone, what percentage of those rides were an accessible vehicle, how often you had a software disengagement, and you know whether or not these are reasonable. A lot of companies went and shifted their testing to Arizona, which didn't require this reporting. And so I think there's gonna be a bit of a push and pull where cities should work together and should work with technical talent. And I know this is happening in cities like Boston and Los Angeles, which have been, you know, leaders in starting to think about these questions, but to formulate what sort of data is going to be helpful, what are we trying to accomplish, and let's formulate this as how do we make this better for everyone rather than who wins and who owns the data? Because I think if we formulate it that way, it becomes adversarial. And I think an adversarial relationship, at the best case, it forces, if companies begin to market shop, in the worst case, I think we have less than ideal outcomes, you know, for all stakeholders.
Today, we chatted a great deal about the standards of the industry and what would be in the greatest service to the population. Ending on a more personalized note, I wanted to pose a special design question to Amitai. So just imagine for a second now, it's yourself or maybe you're with your family and you've got this autonomous pod that's going to pick you up and you're going from Boston to New York City, right? You got a 2-hour ride. What would you want inside this autonomous car? What would be your ideal, fun, exciting, entertaining ride to New York City?
Well, Ed, I don't know how fast you drive, but I've never gotten from Boston to New York in 2 hours. But I'm looking forward to this trip. I would love screens inside so I can catch up on my TV, because I don't get the opportunity to do that very often. And also a smooth ride so I can do my reading. Like, and not get car sick.
You have wife and kids, I think, right?
Yes.
What would they want to do?
Oh, they got it. Right. We got to get a separate screen for...
Yeah, it can't be just about you.
For everyone. Exactly. Right. And yeah, so I mean, I'm really looking forward to reclaiming the car, because we do a lot of trips in the car together, right? I mean, it's always like, okay, so if I'm driving, does the wife go in the front seat? Does she go in the back seat with the kids? Because they're still pretty little, and help take care of them. And I'd love to, it would be amazing to have a car where we didn't have to make that decision. And, you know, car time was family time.
Perfect. Well, you never know. It might not be that far away, right? At least maybe you can all have scooters soon. We'll start with that, right? And work our way up. Special thanks to Amitai Bin-Nun for joining us today. And for more, visit Siemens PLM Software online. Siemens PLM Software is a world-leading provider of product lifecycle management and manufacturing operations management software. We help thousands of companies realize innovation by optimizing their processes from planning and development through manufacturing, production, and support.
Guys, it's Jeff again. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. A big thanks again to Amitai and also to Ed for some excellent interviewing. And before I forget, Amitai is a great follow on Twitter. So if you do the Twitter, check him out there. He's easy to find. Lots of good stuff in his feed. We have more good guests coming up, including an interview with Catherine Sheriff, who has a legal background. She's now at a firm called Emergent Technology Consultants. I was just checking her out on LinkedIn, and she has a paper posted on tort liability and autonomy that, for the decade ending in 2016, was a top paper in terms of downloads on the Social Science Research Network, which is a big deal in the peer review world. So there's lots of people interested in what she has to say, and liability is obviously a huge topic as transportation evolves. Lastly, you know what I'm going to say. Let us know how we're doing. I actually heard from a listener, Amit, in India. Thanks so much for writing. And Amit, send that voice memo when you can and let us know if we can use it in an episode. We will. Amit or anybody can email me at jeff_cook@mentor.com. That's jeff_KOCH at mentor.com. And if you're so inclined, leave us a review on iTunes. I was just over there. And holy smokes, there are lots of podcasts these days related to autonomous vehicles and the future of transportation. So let us know what we can do better among this crowd and what kind of conversations we might feature to provide information that's useful to you or maybe even entertaining. This podcast is produced by Jenny Sarasvati and her team at Jenny Media. Really appreciate their help as always. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.